The title of today's forum is Oxford Human Rights Consortium, Teaching Peace in Times of War, Reflections on Violence and Nonviolence in the 21st Century. And it is co-sponsored by the Office for Global Engagement, the Center for Global Justice, S.J. Quinney College of Law, Honors College, Daniels Fund Ethics Initiative, David Eccles School of Business, and the Tanner Center for Human Rights. Our guest today is Professor Chini Ryan, who is a visiting fellow at the Oxford Institute for Ethics, Law, and Armed Conflict, where he is engaged in a multi-year project exploring the relation of pacifism and nonviolence to contemporary just war theory. Professor Ryan is a professor of philosophy and professor of law at the University of Oregon, where he is a founder of the master's program on conflict resolution. He has also taught at Harvard Law School and Northwestern University and has been a fellow of the Oxford Changing Character of War program. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Well, thank you very much. It's great. I've been at Utah several times over the years and always had a very good time here. And also now I had the great pleasure last March of working at Oxford with students both from Utah and surrounding campuses, so that was a great experience. Dean always urges me to say a little bit about myself before I begin the formal part of our program, so I'll just say a couple of things that are actually related to the kinds of issues I'm going to be talking about. My father was a professional boxer and then decided fairly early on to try and become a movie actor. Very quickly, though, in his career, he went into the Marine Corps and served in the Marine Corps during World War II. He emerged from that experience a lifelong committed pacifist. And that's probably the major influence on me, and you'll hear that undertone in what I'm saying today. He married my mother, who was a Quaker, and together they started a school whose slogan was Education for Peace. So that's very much part of my background, and I have to say that particularly my father's experiences having fought in a war and feeling that that was something that no one should ever do or have to do again. And that's one of the things that I'll be talking about today is that that fact or that belief. My own experience was kind of rocky after that. I got involved in the civil rights movement, the anti-war movement in the 1960s. My involvement in anti-war stuff was always religiously based. That actually separates me from other people somewhat. It was based both in a certain reading of Catholicism as well as Quakerism. And then I had a rather rocky educational career. I was involved in anti-war demonstrations and was expelled from college and actually never got a bachelor's degree. I don't have a bachelor's degree. I was a dishwasher for a while, and I talked my way into graduate school, thinking that that would be more fun than being a dishwasher the rest of my life, and I was right about that. But I've always sort of felt because of that, I've always had kind of an odd relationship with academia, because I've been aware that I want to be an academic, it's important, but I've always sort of thought we couldn't just be academics, we had to be engaged in the world, and particularly we had to talk to students about being engaged in the world, and that's one of the reasons why now that I'm mainly at Oxford, we're involved in starting these human rights workshops and stuff, which your students have been involved in and will hopefully have more of your students engaged in. Okay. So what I've done is I've given a handout, and one of the reasons is because I'm going to give you some statistics, and I always have problems with statistics if I don't have them in front of me. The other thing is it has some references in it. Not probably as many as there should be, because a lot of what I'm going to be saying is very controversial. So the fact that I assert it does not mean there isn't a huge amount of argument about it. In fact, everything I say is going to be controversial. I'll just assert it for now, and then in discussions, maybe we can talk about it, and we can talk about what the countervailing view would be. Actually, though, let me begin with, if you turn the page over, let me begin with what I call the Great Defection. The reference here is actually the title of this little handout, a recent book by James Sheehan called Where Have All the Soldiers Gone? This is a book about contemporary attitudes towards contemporary military affairs in Western Europe and the Northern Hemisphere. And it talks about an issue that seems to be consistent throughout sort of what used to be called the developed countries. And what that is the radical decline of interest on the part of ordinary people to participate in war. The radical decline of interest of ordinary people to participate in war. And let me just begin with a striking figure, which is right below that. In 1965, the draft, conscription, was the most popular institution in the United States. The draft in 1965 was the most popular institution in the United States, more popular than what? The post office. Okay. In 1966, still almost 80% of Americans supported the draft. And in 1968, which was well into the Vietnam War, May 68 is considered the turning point of the Vietnam War, 50% of Americans still supported the draft. There has been no greater change, I think, in my lifetime than this. Because what it indicates is not just an attitude towards participating in war. I actually think it raises a question about what citizenship means. Because the reason why Americans supported the draft was that they thought that participating in their country's wars was what it meant to be an American citizen. That's what it meant to be an American citizen, was to serve in war. Okay? Does that mean it anymore? I think not. I think we live in a dramatically different world right now. I'm not saying that America people don't still celebrate, quote unquote, those who do serve in war. What I mean is that the average American has absolutely no interest in serving in a war, and that's why reviving a draft would be political suicide. And notice that this is something that is now shared by Democrats and Republicans. It's not something that distinguishes the political parties. It is an attitude towards war and citizenship that is dramatically different. And the first question I want to pose is, why has that happened? And what I'm first going to suggest is it's happened because our experience of war in the 20th century has been so terrible. So it's very much a reaction to that. It's not just there's many other factors, but part of it is that the experience of war in the last 100 years has been truly terrible, and I think people have honestly responded to that. Now, that doesn't mean to say that we don't still have questions about war. We don't still have questions about the kinds of engagements that the United States gets involved in. But what it does mean to me is, and my thesis is stated on the top of this, I think human beings are sick of war. I think that's a major change. And I think that in some sense what we need to talk about now is, what does peace mean? What is peace going to look like, and how do we create it? Because there has been what I call the great disillusionment. So let me go back to the first page of this, the great disillusionment. That's the disillusionment with the enterprise of war. Now, let me first talk about the 20th century. Some of you may be familiar with these figures. Let me go over them quickly. Let me talk about the 20th century, but what I'm going to immediately say is that the figures you're getting are radically clustered in the first half of the 20th century. So I say it's the 20th century, but it's actually mainly the first half of the 20th century that we see so much political violence. We start to see that decline. Maybe after giving these figures, I'll just stop for a moment and ask for some hands about what do you think would explain this? Because actually, people disagree about what explains about it. I mean, I have my own view, but maybe we could just talk for a moment about that, and then I'll get back to what I have to say. But let's look at the figures first. The 20th century is generally regarded by historians as the bloodiest century in human history. The bloodiest century in human history. Now, that's a big claim. It's also contentious. Some people would argue that the 17th century had a great deal of political violence. So it's contentious. But there are serious historians. One of them is Neil Ferguson, from whom I get these remarks from. There are serious historians, like Neil Ferguson at Harvard, who says the 20th century was the worst century in human history for political violence. I didn't know that, by the way. I knew there was a lot of war in the 20th century. I didn't know I'd been living in the worst century of human history. 275 wars, 115 million deaths in battle, estimated. That comes to 3,000 deaths per day, or 130 deaths per hour, 24 hours per day throughout the entire century. That's how much political killing of combatants there was. But the 20th century was a century, perhaps the first century, in which more people were killed by war who were not soldiers than were soldiers. So for the first time in the 20th century, you actually see more people dying from wars that are non-combatants or civilians. And by the way, that's a dramatic fact about war today. A dramatic fact about war today is how few people killed are soldiers and how many people that die are non-soldiers. And it's a terrible fact, obviously, about war today. If you add civilian deaths to this figure, you get 250 million people died in the 20th century, 7,000 people a day, 300 people per hour. Now, anyone, those of you who are social scientists are probably thinking, well, there are more people alive in the 20th century, so of course you'd have more deaths. Makes sense. More people, more deaths. But then look at the comparative figures. The comparative figures are actually even more striking. In the 18th century, there were 5 deaths per 1,000 due to war. So you understand that for every 1,000 persons in the 18th century, 5 of them died due to armed conflict. In the 19th century, there were 6 deaths per 1,000 due to armed conflict. In the 20th century, there were 46 deaths per 1,000 due to armed conflict. That is a qualitative leap, roughly 8 times higher than the previous century. What do you think explains this? Let's just spend a couple of minutes. Any thoughts about, yeah? What do you mean we've gotten better at killing people?
We have a lot more advanced technology, which does the job of eliminating targets, but at the same time, there's been a lot of collateral that's come out of that new technology as well.
Okay, so technology would be a factor. Any other thoughts about what might explain this? Yeah, yeah.
The total war strategy.
Oh, yeah.
The total war strategy of the 20th century with World War I and World War II, just everyone was involved in the war?
Right, so that's a political fact. First is a technological fact, second is a political fact. Maybe let's take one more thought. Yeah, hurry.
Increasing geographical, administrative, and philosophical distance between the attackers and the attacked.
What do you have in mind? I know what you mean, but what do you mean by that?
The ability of policymakers to wage war from afar, that is, not bear witness to the consequences of their decisions.
Okay. Now, all of those are factors that we could talk about, and they're important factors. Let me just make a comment on one or two of them. In my own view, the changes in technology are the least useful in understanding why so many people were killed. We certainly had machine guns by World War I, but we had machine guns by the late 19th century. There were machine guns then, so that machine gun was not a new technology to the 20th century. A new technology was poison gas. But you may, if you've studied this, you know poison gas turned out to be a phenomenally ineffective weapon, and it was not even used that much, and then it was dropped, okay? The other thing which we had was air power, and certainly air power has been responsible for a lot of killing in modern wars. But actually, when you look at the number of people killed by airstrikes, it turns out this is not really add on very much to it. So the technology thing is the one that I think is probably the one that would be most contentious, political changes, sort of distancing things. But let me mention one change that I would emphasize. What was new about World War I was not that there were people shooting machine guns at other people. What was new about it was that there were thousands of people willing to run into those machine guns. That's what you had not seen. What you had not seen was people who were willing to sacrifice themselves in actions that look to us like they're suicidal. Suicidal, the Battle of the Somme, World War I. As many people died in 1 or 2 days in the Battle of the Somme as died in the entire Vietnam War on the part of America. Okay, what explains it? What explains it, in my view, is a way of thinking that people will, for God and country, run into a machine gun when they know that their chances of being killed are 98%. That's what's changed, because I don't think people think that way anymore. I don't think you can mobilize people that way anymore on the scale that you did before. And that's what I call the great disillusionment. There has been a qualitative change in the romance of war. Now, most of that was clustered in pre-1945. So the reason why these statistics are inaccurate is that most of it was clustered in pre-1945. After 1945, you start to have a monumental change in the nature of war, and you start to have a monumental decline in the number of people that are killed. Now let me preface this by saying something. I don't mean to underestimate the horrible facts of people being killed in the world today. I don't mean to in any way dishonor that fact or deny it. But the reality is that if you look at the gross figures of how many people have been killed in conflict in the last 30 years, what you see is a graph that goes like that. There's a dramatic decline in the amount of political killing. What does that look like? Okay. Well, first of all, the most striking fact compared to European history, the most striking fact compared to the previous 300 years is that there have been no wars between major developed powers since 1945. There's not been a single war between major developed powers. Now, I think, you know, I, as someone who grew up after all this, kind of took that for granted. But the reality is, if you remember your European history, for 300 years, all that happened was that France and Britain and Germany fought against each other. None of that has happened since 1945. Question I'll pose, won't get into it now. Why? Why have there been no major wars like that? The second type of war that you have are wars where major powers basically invade and try to occupy a less developed country or something like that. Okay? The two most prominent examples of that are the American War in Vietnam and the Soviet War in Afghanistan. These are examples of post-World War II conflicts. Major power goes into another country and basically fights a conflict where they're essentially fighting a guerrilla or popular resistance, okay? The one thing we'd want to say about that is they all lose. They all lose. America lost in Vietnam. Soviets lost in Afghanistan. I'll get back to this, but that's the significant fact about those kinds of wars. You don't win them. The third type of war is the type of war that goes on now, and I've just given you a couple of examples of this. These are civil wars. The main type of conflict you have today are civil wars. And I've given you, these are examples in roughly in descending order in terms of the number of people killed. These are examples of civil wars. So the most serious one in terms of people killed is the war in Afghanistan. Next to that, the Boko Haram insurgency. After that, the Syrian civil war, et cetera, et cetera. Some of these Americans we're familiar with. I'm afraid that many of them as Americans we know nothing about. They happen off the radar for us. The most significant war in the last 100 years, the most significant war in the Western Hemisphere is the Mexican Drug War. Did everyone know that? Did you know that the most significant war of the last 100 years in the Western Hemisphere is going on right now? It's the Mexican Drug War. 120,000 people killed. Most significant war. Let me mention that because I think we should know about it, and I think we should be more aware of it. But there's a further reason. If you want to ask yourself, what does a war look like now? A good model is the Mexican Drug War. That's what wars look like now. They look like the Mexican Drug War. They are internal conflicts. They often have as much to do with who's going to control the resources, or to put it a little more crudely, who's going to steal from who. They don't seem to have these large ideologies associated with them. In some cases now, we're aware they have a religious dimension to them. The ones in the Middle East have a religious dimension to them, but actually they're similar regardless of whether they have a religious dimension or not. So I'll get back to those. Okay. Maybe we'll talk about those a little bit. Now, my claim is, yeah.
I just wanted to know, where is Donbass?
It's in Africa. Yeah. It's in Donbass. I mean, I'm sorry. No, you're right. I thought you were referring. I thought you were asking about the Boko Haram thing. Yeah. It's in the Ukraine. Ukraine. We'll get back to that. Okay. Yeah. Now, my suggestion is that part of what we're looking at here, in the terms of the changing nature of war, and certainly war between developed countries, is that people don't want to fight in wars anymore. So this gets back now. Let me go on page 2 to the popularity of war. Now, if I can be a little cynical for a moment, certainly American politicians oftentimes are very in favor of war. So I'm not talking about whether the political rhetoric is in favor of wars and thinks that wars can be a good thing. I'm talking about whether the average American, given the choice, has any interest in actually fighting the war themselves. Okay? What we found was in the Iraq War that the answer was no. The story of the Iraq War from the inside was very much a story that they could not get enough soldiers to fight it. This is one of the things I do academically. I study this. Anyone who was studying the Iraq conflict 2004, 2005 was reading literature that the military could not get enough soldiers. The minute, in fact, that war started, they had trouble enlisting people. And I think I give you some statistics here. Recruitment problems. 2004, 2005, we started to see a 10% shortfall in recruiting goals in the military. It's interesting to see why this happened, and I give you some statistics here. The main reason it happened was that there was a dramatic decline in African-American recruitments. African-Americans made up 30 to 40% of the military at the time, and there was a 40% decline in African-American recruitments from 2001 to 2005, and that was the main reason why there was a decline in enlistments 2005 during the Iraq War. Now, let me ask you again, what does that tell us about why people are enlisting if what we see is that there's a 40% decline once a war starts? What do you think? What are you going to find out when you then go back and ask people why they enlisted in the first place? Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm so sorry. That there are financial reasons attached.
Yes. People will enlist in the military as long as they know that there's no possibility they'll fight a war. That's what the evidence shows. People will enlist in the military as long as they know that there's no possibility of fighting in a war. As soon as a war starts, you will start to see dramatic declines in people wanting to enlist. And the book, Where Have All the Soldiers Gone?, basically is the thesis that this is true of every major developed country. If you look at why people do enlist, they enlist for economic reasons. As soon as that economic reason is no longer a compelling one, they will stop enlisting. And so what you have today in general with America fighting wars is that, in some sense, it goes into it with the problem they can't get enough soldiers. Okay. Now, let me make my cynical remark. Politicians, though, say America has to stand strong, and America needs to fight wars when necessary, and that's what it means to be an American. Okay. But what came up during the Iraq War is how few of those politicians have their own children enlisting in the military, and how few of those politicians, when they had the chance, didn't enlist in the military themselves. This leads to an issue of hypocrisy, which I've actually written a whole book about, okay, the morality of that, all right. But I did looked at your two senators from Utah earlier today. Now, I should say that this is across Democrat versus Republican divides. This is not a comment about Republicans versus Democrats, but I was interested in it. I saw that Orrin Hatch has three sons. The three sons were all of military service age. during the Afghanistan-Iraq conflict, which he vigorously supported. Orrin Hatch did not. None of his sons, as far as I could tell, had served in the military. Orrin Hatch somehow didn't serve in the military. I'm not clear how that happened, because Orrin Hatch was certainly of an age where everyone was drafted, but he had no military service. And your other senator, Mike Lee, is that his name? Mike Lee is now calling for remaining in Afghanistan until every last bad guy is killed. He obviously hasn't talked to a military person to imagine what that would actually look like. But Mike Lee, too, it doesn't seem to me, from what I can see, that there's any sense that supporting a war means you have to fight it yourself. See, that's what's been lost. What's been lost is the idea that supporting a war means you should fight it yourself. When 90% of Americans in 1965 supported the draft, it's because they did think that supporting a war meant fighting it yourself. That's why Elvis Presley went into the military. Elvis Presley, some of you know who Elvis Presley is. Elvis Presley was given five ways to get out of military service. He was given five ways to get out of military service, top of his career. There's reason to think that Elvis sincerely thought that I'm an American like everybody else, and what it means to be an American is to serve in the military. Top of his career, he went and drove a tank in Germany for 2 years. Can you imagine that happening today? Don't we live in a completely different world? I think we should acknowledge that fact, and we should in some sense ask, what does it mean then that we're living in a world where we really don't want to fight wars anymore? Why don't we want to fight them? A lot of reasons. The idea that war is manly is not as attractive to people as it used to be. But there's a further reason. You can't win them. Now, this is going to get very controversial, but let me mention, I'm now going to just briefly skate through what's called the unconquerable world thesis. I'm going to go down to four and go back to three. The unconquerable world thesis is that war is now useless. War simply does not work. If you compare now to previous times, you can certainly point to previous times in history where war was an effective strategy. But the unconquerable world thesis, and there's a book by this title by Jonathan Schell, if you're interested in this, basically says that war has lost its utility. And so part of it is not just the terrible problems that come with war, but also the fact that it is now useless. I was in Oxford. I was already spending time there in the 2000s when the United States had gone into Afghanistan and Iraq. They're going into Afghanistan and Iraq now. There were specific reasons for going to Afghanistan related to the attack of 9/11. There were specific reasons for going in Iraq related to the weapons of mass destruction. But clearly, in going into those countries, they were going into a situation where they knew they would face some sort of popular insurgency. Arguments about how much they knew that or whether they underestimated it. They clearly knew they were going to go into a country and face a popular insurgency. I was sitting in a discussion with a member of the British military, and a man raised his hand. His name is Adam Roberts, leading thinker on war and peace. And he said to the man in the British military, can you name one example of where a country like the United States or Great Britain has gone into a country like Afghanistan and Iraq? Can you name one example since 1945 where that's worked? Couldn't do it. Couldn't do it. You can't find an example of where a country has gone in and with the face of the task of putting down anything like a popular insurrection and succeeded. This is the claim that it simply doesn't work. By the way, anyone who's telling you that the United States should go back into Iraq and deal with the ISIS situation, the first thing to ask him is, when has a country done this and succeeded in putting down what looks obviously like an insurrection with some support? Okay? When your Senator Mike Lee says we should stay in Afghanistan until we get the job done, a question to ask is, when has any country since 1945 gotten that job done? Okay? Doesn't happen. So I actually think here that the people who are anti-war, like me, are the realists. I think things have flipped, quite frankly. I think that people who think that war is a massive waste of time are now the realists, and the people that are living in fantasy land are the people who think that you can just go into a country like this and do the job, you know, and be out after spending $200 million the way they said we would do in Iraq, okay? And, of course, finally, there are the terrible costs. Let me run through these quickly because I want to have some time for questions. I think we've not only realized that war is not very effective, we've realized that it's costly in a way that was not clear to people before. The example I give here, this is now up to three, the hidden costs of war. I've given you some figures on post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, this is something I've studied a lot, and it's an interesting thing that there's no reason to think that this problem has gotten worse. Now it seems as if there was always post-traumatic stress disorder. It's just that people were not aware of it or didn't think of it that way. The first time in the United States people became aware of it, it was called an irritable heart. I think that's an interesting phrase. And if I were going to write a book about post-traumatic stress disorder, I think an interesting topic would be, I mean, a title would be an irritable heart. And here's why. Is it just a medical problem? Or does post-traumatic stress disorder arise from the fact that people themselves in combat realize that what they're doing is something that is fundamentally at odds with their humanity? Early on, people thought it was just a medical problem. And increasingly, people are saying, no, it has a moral dimension. The moral dimension is, in war, we're asking people to do things that are at odds with their humanity. And if you ask them to do it enough, they will develop psychological problems from it, okay? And that's kind of where the thinking about that has gone. And to me, again, it contributes to this disillusionment with war. In the Vietnam War, 31% of male veterans now, we believe, had PTSD. 27% of female veterans had PTSD sometime in their lives. Many of them are still alive, so these figures go on. But you're looking at basically a third of those veterans. Now, let me point out to you, this does not distinguish people who actually experienced combat, people who didn't experience combat. You're a Vietnam veteran if you even got within the area, okay? So the figures, obviously, for people who experienced combat are much higher than that. Afghanistan-Iraq war, well, what we see now so far is 20% rate of PTSD in those wars. But, of course, you see, the problem is what Vietnam suggests is that much of the PTSD is developed after the fact. Some of you have seen the figures on suicides that we're dealing with today, 22 veterans per day, one every 65 minutes, 6,500 veterans have killed themselves in 2013 alone. Now, I won't go into the second thing, but the theory now is, at least a common theory now is, that this is not just a medical problem. This is because engaging in war and conflict raises moral questions which then scar you and need to be addressed, okay? And this is one of the human costs of war. It translates into the economic costs of war. So I give you some statistics here. Look down to number 5. All of this is on war's true hidden costs, and I'll wrap up in a minute with why I think, well, what do we do now? Is one of the things is we talk about war's human costs and its true costs. We try and talk about what the full costs are. I've coined a term that I've written about elsewhere called alienated war, and I think that what we do now in the United States to some extent is what I call alienated war. The term covers a number of things. One of the things it means is that people who support wars want other people to fight it. That, to me, is sort of alienated. I mean, if I supported a war, I would think I should fight it myself. Now we're in favor of wars. Now we want someone else to fight it. You saw this in the Iraq War dramatically because by the end of the Iraq conflict, major involvement, over 50% of American soldiers were not even in the American military. Maybe we're aware of that. They were called contract soldiers. So they're professional soldiers. They're called mercenaries that were hired basically to come in and do it, because the U.S. military could not get enough soldiers to do it themselves. The other thing about alienated war is simply that, are we truly aware of its costs? And this is one of the things that, I mean, in terms of my own work in education, I mean, I know it's not the most, it's kind of a depressing topic, but one of the things I just simply point out to people is, do you know how much these things cost in terms of lives and money? All controversial how they estimate this, but roughly a credible estimate for the cost of the Iraq War is $4 to $6 trillion when it's over and done with. The Iraq War will be, in adjusted dollars, the most expensive war in American history, next to World War II. Do you remember how it was financed? Do you remember how they financed the Iraq War? Borrowing. The president decided that he could not ask people to pay taxes for the war. In my view, that's because then they'd know it was actually costing something. So they financed the Iraq War by borrowing, which means that not me, by the way, but you, your children, and their children will actually be paying the bill for the Iraq War. They'll be paying $4 to $6 trillion for a comparator. The cost of Obamacare from 2016 to 2025 is $1.2 trillion. So if you add up the entire estimated cost of Obamacare up until the year 2025, it comes to basically 1/4 to 1/6 of what we will spend on the Iraq War alone. This is astonishing, but the main question I want to raise is, do people really know this? Is this something that we know of, or is it something that is hidden to us from by alienated war? Okay. So where do we go next? Let me raise a couple of things about things to think about, and then I'll wrap this up. First of all, I think we need to educate people on what war looks like. I think war itself has done this, but I think war has lost its romance. And I think we need to do a better job at simply explaining to people what war really looks like. So that's why, even though I know it's kind of difficult to dwell on these sort of psychological issues and boring at times on the financial issues, the fact of the matter is that America is paying this cost with its own citizens. And also, by the way, when America fights a war, the cost to the other countries is always 10, 15, 20 times higher. Okay, but the true cost of war, I think, is hidden from us. And so I think we need to educate people that we have been in a time of war. The second thing is an interesting question I have no answer to, but and maybe you could give me some feedback in a moment about this. What it's meant to be patriotic in the past has been that you supported the country's wars. That's what those figures show in 1965 about the draft. What it meant to be patriotic was you supported wars. And by the way, in the past it meant, and you did that, really you did it, you didn't just celebrate troops, you paid for it, you fought in it, whatever. What does it mean if we separate patriotism from warfare? Two questions there. Can we do it? Can we have a peaceful patriotism? Or is patriotism itself something that is so connected with war that the very idea of patriotism is questionable? I'd love to hear what your thoughts are about that, because I go both ways on that. I mean, I think that people are patriotic, and we will have patriotism. And so if we want to sort of move away from this involvement with war, we need to think about what another type of patriotism is. I have to say, though, my religious upbringing goes in the other direction. I was raised to think that the nation state was idolatry. That was how I was raised. The celebration of nation states and what nation states do in war is a form of idolatry, and that patriotism is itself a form of idolatry. So I was raised religiously to think that what you needed to do was get rid of all that. Okay, that's clearly, though, a marginal view, and I'm not sure, you know, how far that would go. The final thing I'll mention, so maybe we could talk about that. The final thing I want to ask about is, what does peace look like? And I pose it in terms of negative versus positive peace. I have talked entirely in terms of things like people killed in battles. The question, though, is, if we stop the battles, do we really have peace? Or is peace much more than simply people stopping killing each other? And that's the question that I think people raise about the literature that I've been drawing on for the last 40 minutes. What people say is, well, we may have seen a dramatic decline in deaths in battle, but does that really show that we've ended violence? Or have we simply moved to other forms of violence which are not combat related. I was in a discussion in the Honors College right before I came over here, and they brought up human trafficking, the problem of human trafficking. That won't show up in the statistics I've got, but do we live in a peaceful world where that goes on? Okay. So the three issues are, I'm concluding with, is, you know, what are we going to do to educate people more about the world they have lived in? What might patriotism look like, or should we have it if we can detach it from warfare? And the third would be, is a world without war, as it's traditionally defined, really a world with peace? Thank you very much. We can talk about it.
We'll now open it to question and answer. Please state your name into the mic and a little bit about yourself.
My name is Margith Mon, and I was just wondering your opinion about the war talk surrounding Iran. Do you have an opinion on our chances there?
Our chances of
Going to war or not going to war?
Well, our chances of winning a war are zero, I can assure you of that, partly because when we go to these wars, we don't even know what winning looks like anymore. I mean, I didn't get into that, but part of the problem is that in previous wars, it was always a little bit clear about what victory looked like. Now we get into wars, and very, very quickly it turns out that it's not even clear what is being achieved. I would think a war with Iran is unlikely, and I would think a war with Iran is unlikely because I don't imagine the U.S. military has any interest in doing it. You know, the U.S. military was not in favor of the action in Iraq. And the British military was really not in favor of the Iraq war. But what happened was that the political part of the government prevailed over there. But I don't think the U.S. military is not happy getting into wars like that. And I would think, among other reasons, I would think there would be such resistance. Now, that doesn't mean there might not be bombs dropped. You know, go in and drop some bombs on something. But that's not a war. That's an armed exchange. That might happen. But Iran, I should say, by the way, as you probably know, I mean, Iran is a totally different story than Iraq. It's three times the size population-wise. It's a developed country. They actually have a very small military, but the ability to conquer it would be zero. And so the question would arise, in my view, about what would be accomplished by a military strike against it. Yeah, that's a good question. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Connor Workman, and I'm a freshman studying game design at the U. My question is, do you think war has now become a kind of global source of anxiety as opposed to a source of patriotism or honor? I think that has become especially visible in issues like the Ukrainian conflict with Russia, where everyone was kind of scattered to retain peace without conflict. What are your views on that?
Well, I guess I think generally there is not the link between war and nationalism or patriotism that there used to be. Now I'm saying that very strongly. I mean, clearly, in the 2004 election, President Bush, I mean, his victory in that election was partly to do with sort of identifying himself as the more patriotic candidate. And you see that you saw that when Margaret Thatcher was prime minister. In some sense, she was saved by the Falkland War because there was a huge upswell of patriotism then. But I think this patriotism is fairly superficial compared to the past. And so even when it arises, it's not long-lasting. That would be my view, because it doesn't reach down deep. You know, it's not something that, in the way that patriotism in World War II really reached down, you know, people had to pay more taxes, they were serving. You know, now we have wars where, you know, people, money's borrowed, other people fight it. What does patriotism grab onto there? You see, so that would be that's generally my feeling about that.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Jessica, I'm a freshman at the University of Utah. Hi. I just wanted to, so I agree with you that the patriotism is one of the biggest factors that leads people into the military or war. But in my opinion, I think United States being the strongest country in the world also leads, it's inevitable for America to not get involved in the war, because for decades, the United States have involved in other countries' conflict and all the issues. And I think it's important that America, being the strongest country, kind of troubleshoot the problem between the countries and just work things out. I think that's the role of this being the strongest country in the world. I think that's what this country is supposed to do. What's your opinion about it?
Well, let me play devil's advocate for a moment. So the suggestion is that by virtue of being the strongest country, we have the greatest obligation to help resolve conflicts in other parts of the world, okay? Does it follow from that China, which is the second strongest country, then has the next greatest obligation to solve problems in the rest of the world? And does it follow from that? You probably see where I'm going with this. I actually think that we tend to think that other countries which are very, very militarily strong should not bother themselves at all with other parts of the world. And as Americans, we can be very chauvinistic about feeling like, well, it's up to us to do that. So I would kind of worry about there's a kind of an arrogance about that, you know, that we know what's best for people. But I would go back to the other point. I don't think America's record of solving these problems is very successful. I really don't. I mean, it's very hard to find cases where America's intervening or anyone's intervening really led unquestionably to a positive outcome. I mean, look at Libya. I mean, there was all this thing about, well, if we overthrow Libya, you know, that will be a duty, you know, fulfilling our duty to the world community, you know. Libya's complete chaos now. It's true Gaddafi's not there, but it would be hard to argue that things are really qualitatively better after that intervention, okay? So there's both a kind of, the question, Jessica, is that your name? Yeah, Jessica. I would raise, first of all, a very pragmatic question about does it really work? And the second one is that I'd raise some questions about, well, what is, though, the kind of implicit assumptions about, because I worry the assumption is not just America's the strongest country, America's the most virtuous country, you know, and it's kind of up to us to solve people's problems for them. And I would have serious doubts about that. So that would be my own thoughts there. Thank you.
My name is Pratik Raghu, and I'm from Westminster College. Cheney, my question for you is as follows. Has the world as a whole transitioned from a proclivity for fast violence to a proclivity for slow violence? And does lasting, sustainable peace mean the eradication of slow violence in its various manifestations? We are all bang smack in the middle of the Anthropocene at the moment, an epoch that has come at tremendous cost for not just the planet, but also many less privileged peoples who mm-hmm. call it home. Mm-hmm. Has war become less popular among the developed nations of the world in particular because it is no longer necessary to extract resources and exploit the global south to achieve the ends of Western hegemony?
Well, I'm going to waffle a little bit here because I'll say it's a little bit of both. There was always different models of imperialism, and American imperialism, when we had that, was always a softer version. I mean, it was always a version that was not as heavy-handed as some other forms were. And so one could say, well, then what we're just seeing now is a kind of the development of sort of exploitive and unequal relationships that are just not as heavy-handed and don't require military intervention. I think there's some truth to that. But I would say there's also the truth that when they've tried to militarily intervene, it doesn't work. So it's not as if they're avoiding military intervention because it's just a second-best solution. It's not a solution at all. I mean, the record of those kinds of interventions is truly terrible. You can't get people to participate in them. So I would argue that this notion of the disillusionment of what I'm calling that is an independent factor. I obviously weigh it more than other people do, but I think it's a factor of its own. And I think that's an achievement, by the way. I mean, I think that at a certain point, human society came to feel that slavery was not something that it was going to officially ratify anymore. Now, we could, of course, talk about how there's informal forms of slavery, whatever. But nevertheless, it was a very important achievement when the kind of consensus came about, no, slavery as we've known it is something that we're no longer going to support. And I like to think that we live in a time like that with war. I like to, and we just simply need to acknowledge it. The problem is that the United States still spends $500 billion a year on its military budget. Think of how many problems in human trafficking and stuff we could solve to do that. Do we really need $500 billion a year? So there's a disconnect, I think, with American politics and what I've been describing. But I think it's solvable. I mean, I actually think that this is something, that's why I believe in education. We talk about it enough, people can see we really don't need to do this anymore. We don't need to spend that kind of money. Yeah.
I'm Harris Sondak. Presumably Senator Lee knows that war is futile and expensive, or could find that out easily enough.
Right.
And I think Senator Lee probably is not facing a difficult re-election, given...
I don't know that. I mean, I actually know nothing about him.
I don't know. Other people in this room probably know that better than I do, but I'll just postulate that, given that he's a Republican from Utah, in control of the machinery of the Republicans in Utah. So what's his agenda?
Well, knowing nothing about Senator Lee, I assume that tough talk has a life of its own among politicians. And I chose Senator Lee, but I mean, we could walk through Democratic politicians and give examples of how, you know, they would say, you know, we have to stand up to country X. Now, I would say I don't understand... I lived in the East Coast for a long time, so I understand why politicians take certain very bellicose positions in the East Coast on the Middle East because of the demographics of who lives in their states and stuff. I can't possibly see why the people of Utah would feel strongly about staying in Afghanistan for the next 30 years. I don't know. I mean, I can't see any, you know, electoral reason for doing it. But I think that it has become kind of an addiction in this country, you know, of you can't appear soft, you know, you have to appear whatever, and, you know, that's all right as long as it doesn't lead to anything. I don't know, do you have a theory about, you know about more about Senator Lee than I do.
Well, I don't mean him so individually, it's just that you identified him as someone who says we should stay until the last bad guy is caught.
Yeah, that's what I found out this morning, you know.
Going on, and I'm just trying to understand what it might be. If what you're trying to do is advocate for peace, it's worthwhile thinking about why people are advocating for war when they perfectly well know it's futile and expensive.
Well, I mean, I think there's all kinds of, I think there's ideologies, and some of it was based on what Jessica was saying about, you know, America's a powerful country, and it's very, you know, America, if it sees something upset about, you know, should do something about it and get its way. I mean, by itself, by the way, I mean, there's good aspects of feeling that way. You should do things about problems. But I just think it's part of an ideology of, but I have to say, I mean, I find a lot of American ideology stranger than most people do. I was watching this morning Hillary Clinton's announcement, and then there was a series of things after this. And Hillary Clinton said something which every politician says, which is America is the greatest country in the history of the earth. And isn't it the case that if you run for office, you have to say America's the greatest country in the history of earth? Now, first of all, I have empirical questions about that. You know, I mean, I'm saying, really, in the history of earth, there's no other country? But the other thing is, isn't that a kind of an arrogant thing to say about? Isn't there something just fundamentally arrogant about saying we're the greatest country in the history? I mean, suppose you went over to a friend's house. I was thinking about this, like in your college students. You know, suppose you went over to your roommate's house for dinner, and you sat down for dinner with your roommate and their parents, and the father said, "You know, we're the greatest family there is. We're not just a great family; we're the greatest family there is." And then the mother said, "And in fact, we're the greatest family in the history of the earth." You wouldn't sort of think, well, this is an interesting opinion they have. You know, you would sort of think, isn't there fundamentally weird about, you know, thinking about things that way? I mean, don't you want to be the best family you can be? Isn't that enough? Isn't it enough that America wants to be the best country? Does that have to be the greatest country in the history? But, I, you know, look, I can't run for anything. I can't run for dog catcher, right? I mean, if I got up and I said, well, maybe we're not the greatest country in the history of Earth, you know, because that's the ideology of it, right? That's sort of, so I think some of this, I mean, that's why I'm optimistic that we could move beyond it. I think some of it is just ideology inertia. That's what I would say. Yeah. Sorry for, set me off this morning hearing that phrase.
Yeah, Katie Payne.
Hi, Katie.
I wanted to get back to Jessica's question where she asked about our interventionist approach in wars.
Right.
I wanted to get your opinion on intervention in genocides because historically we've not really gotten involved with genocides, and especially considering your background and interest in human rights, I was wondering where you stood on that.
Well, that's a great question because what I've been talking about is wars as they're generally understood and traditionally understood. And I think that the biggest dilemma for someone like me, or the biggest question for someone who's so skeptical of armed conflict is what about genocide? Let me say abstractly that if it was 100% sure that a limited military action would stop a genocide, if that were true abstractly, then I would say, yes, abstractly, we should do it. The problem is we don't live in an abstract world, and the issue that arises for those kind of interventions is, do they actually make things better, or do they make things worse? And to have that discussion, we really need to move on and look at that. And actually, I think, by the way, in the workshops we do with our consortium, I've actually sort of thought that would be a good thing to do another workshop on, is in some sense look actually at how they work out. Because even the clearest cases like, even the cases where people think, well, clearly there should have been intervention there, the more you look at it, the more you realize, no, actually the negative consequences could have been really catastrophic as well. So, but there I would say in principle, I'm not going to reject that out of hand. But I would come back to the issue, we need to look at these things and see if they're actually really effective. Because so often we're told, you know, if we just get rid of Gaddafi, Libya will be fine. If we just get rid of Saddam Hussein, Iraq will be fine. You know, and then what we see is, no, actually things are horrible after that. Maybe that's still necessary to do the thing in the first place, but then we should think more about our obligations after that. You know, we can't just sort of say, let's fight the war like that and get in and get out. It's a good question.
Please join me in thanking Professor Cheney Ryan for such a great forum.